Welcome to the Liberty Free to Be podcast. I've had the pleasure of connecting with women from all over the world, and I'm constantly left feeling uplifted by their stories, their attitude and zest for life. Whenever I'm having a wobble, they've been a great source of encouragement. So I wanted to create a space to not only share their stories and amplify women over 40's voices, but also share my own passion for living a fulfilled life with freedom. Join me as I share a fortnightly dose of midlife motivation, where you get to hear from some amazing people who are leaving a trail of inspiration along the way, breaking down midlife stereotypical barriers, and proving it's never too late to find new passion and purpose. Think of it as your one-stop shop full of real stories you can relate to. Lifestyle inspiration, practical resources, from health and wealth, mindset to menopause, reinvention to rebellion. No subject is off limits. Living a life of liberty, free to be, whatever we want to be in midlife and beyond. So welcome back to a new week of Liberty Free to Be. I hope you've had a great fortnight, and I'm really looking forward to talking to today's guest, Frida Shafi. How do we describe her? She is an artist, a food writer, a food vlogger. She's now got the addition of being a published author. Her book, Suitaland, I've just finished it and it's amazing. It's such a great insight into what life was like in the 70s and 80s, particularly for South Asian women in West Yorkshire. So I'm looking forward to talking to Frida about that. She's also a proud British South Asian woman who is really passionate about really connecting and bringing those underrepresented groups of women together. So welcome, Frida.
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for the lovely introduction as well.
Well, you have lots of strings to your bow, which I'm looking forward to delving into.
Thank you.
Before we get started, so that people get a sense of who you are and what you're about, how would you describe yourself in three words?
Oh, that sounds like an interview question. So let's see. I would describe myself at this moment in time, three words. I would say curious. I would say evolving. And I would happily say a polymath. A polymath is a person that has a variety of different disciplines and celebrates that. We assigned that word to the Renaissance man, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, all men. But I feel like a female polymath who is capable of doing so many things and has the goods to back it up, Rachel.
Really interesting. Thank you. I love those words. I'm looking forward to finding out a lot more about those as we go along.
Thank you.
And that word evolving is actually something that has a kind of common thread with all the women that I interview, because we don't just stay the same. And I do think at this stage of life, we're evolving even more. But can you kind of give us a summary of your timeline to get to where we are now?
I've had, I would say, quite an interesting and diverse route to get to where I am. But I think there's been one consistent thread that has carried me through, and that has always been the very first word I used, actually, of curiosity. And the sense of not being afraid to explore and often dismantle boundaries that I felt growing up were quite limiting, as I'm sure most women have. Actually, that's not restricted to my cultural heritage. I think that's part of being a woman as well. Trying to negotiate life by questioning and being curious about boundaries, often dismantling them as well. So to get to where I am, there was quite a lot of that, actually. I think it stood me and my generation in very good stead. A reason why I felt it was important to write that down in a novel, actually. Yeah.
And let's start with the novel, because it's recently published just before Christmas. I really enjoyed it. And not just because it's got a really important message and there's some really strong female characters in there, which I really was cheering and rooting for, but also this sense of the community around food and how food brings people together. And it did make me want to go and be more adventurous in the kitchen, which I'm sure my husband will be pleased to hear. But yeah, it's such a beautifully written book.
Thank you.
I'm guessing that this has been quite a long process to get to this stage. How does it feel now it's out there?
It's been a long time in the making, Rachel, and turning things around in your head and incubating them and it's like most writers, you have to draw on themes that you saw happening growing up in and around your vicinity. This is a novel, this is a fictional novel, but at the same time, there were things in Yorkshire that I found funny, that I found interesting, that I would often question, and I knew at some point that I would crystallise them somehow, whether it was a book, whether it was a screenplay, whether it was something visual. I am an artist, so my background is I am a qualified fine artist. So I knew that these thoughts had to manifest at some point and be crystallised, as I said. It started in the form of a book, actually, which is what you're talking about, Suitorland. And as you'll have seen, it's peppered with stories and anecdotes, which do pertain to 1970s life. Yeah. But I'm finding with some of the feedback from a lot of the young women who are reading it, they are pulling out strands and saying, actually, Frieda, this is happening now. And you could have quite easily have taken a snapshot of life in my household.
That's which really is interesting. Yeah, that is really interesting.
And whilst I find that it's uplifting because it's relatable and it's resonating, so on the one hand, I am happy about that, but on the other hand, I'm perturbed.
Yeah, there's still a lot of work.
And you know exactly what I'm talking about because there are themes that pertain to patriarchy and a woman's currency being defined by marriage and being defined by ownership. And when I hear that these things are still going on, I feel, whilst I never set out to be an activist, that was never my aim, accidental activist is where I feel as though I'm heading, because I have been urged to speak up about certain themes by, as I said, some of the younger women reading it. So it's interesting. And going back to your question, it's been evolving in my head for a very long time, Rachel.
And how does it feel now it's out there? Because there is a vulnerability when you put yourself out there and do something like this that has got a form of activism in it as well. It does leave you quite vulnerable. Have you embraced that, or is it something that you're learning to sit with more comfortably?
This is probably not the first time I've been in a position of vulnerability. At my age, you do become adept at dealing with situations where you feel there will be some kind of rebuttal.
Yes.
There has been a rebuttal. There has been a backlash from certain areas in the community that feel they're not ready to speak up.
Right.
Or they don't feel that I should be speaking up about these things. I've had to face them with the resilience that I think in our age bracket we get to. When you're in your 50s, you become more resolved about, it sounds quite extreme, an analogy that I use is which fires to put out and which battles to fight, which battles that you can quietly navigate without saying anything, but knowing they will eventually resolve themselves. When people who are perturbed or usually somehow destabilized by what you have written or what you're putting out there, they will evolve themselves. And that is something that I feel you come to with age and you have to accept. You cannot put fires out, especially when you have your own family to look after and your own priorities, which are not necessarily based fighting other people's battles.
Yes, yeah. But I think it's brilliant that you've done that, and it does open up that conversation. But this is not the first time that you've been brave and done that. But you spent the last 20 years really doing lots of different community projects, haven't you? So how have some of those evolved? What sort of work have you done in the past?
Being a fine artist, it wasn't a conventional route, especially for a South Asian young girl to go down.
Yeah.
And I feel as though I broke a few glass ceilings when it came to that. The idea of going to university in the 1980s, 90s, early 90s, I was at university. Again, it was quite an anomaly to have that opportunity, which I believe I worked for. I fought for that. It wasn't handed on a plate. And in the 1970s and 80s, a lot of what our generation did was very much about values and appreciating, and I say opportunities in the widest possible sense. I don't feel as though I was bestowed an opportunity. I worked for it.
Yeah.
But to go down that route, first of all, to be a fine artist was a big thing of my generation. Having broken that glass ceiling, I felt I was in a position to pave the way for the next generation and people, not just from my cultural background, but from any cultural background. Yeah. Going down the route of an arts degree is often considered, the value of it isn't really considered very much. When you do compare it, you know, yeah, the comparison to the art, to the sciences, to law and all the other, yeah, vocational degrees, you know, it raises a few eyebrows. I discovered a path to learning through the arts, which opened my eyes to science, opened my eyes to philosophy. It opened my eyes to a number of disciplines that I don't feel as though I would have learned, or I did learn at school, actually. And seeing that there was an underrepresentation of people of colour, especially POC, to use these definitions, or BAME, whatever you want to call it, Black or Minority Ethnic People in the Arts, I felt it was a responsibility to educate not just the community, but also the institutions. And that was a challenge. That was probably more of a challenge, actually, because I was often given these amazing opportunities, again, not knowingly, from those cultural institutions. There was always a good amount of funding set aside to engage people of whether they were underrepresented through colour or economic background. I was the person for a very long time who was assigned the job of writing those toolkits, of engaging with those communities. And on the one hand, I felt it was an opportunity, but on the other hand, I felt frustrated because it was almost, for me, a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you start to peddle a certain notion, it manifests and it can gain momentum and actually become a huge monster, as opposed to I went into the art seamlessly, not thinking there were barriers to access. Yeah. But when you start talking about barriers to access, it's a double-edged sword. You can start to create barriers to access. So my thinking was quite philosophical, Rachel. And whenever I approached any of those jobs, I did it with integrity, with ethics, and I made sure those institutions were going to sustain that work and make sure that it didn't sit on a shelf in a toolkit just so that a box could be ticked to, yeah, say that was done by a young woman of colour who went into the communities. Yes. I had to make it relevant. So I had to make sure that the institutions were changing, that they were programming, that they were meaningfully engaging with those communities, whether it was to do with an exhibition that would appeal to that specific demographic, or it was to program in a theatrical performance or a opera that would appeal to that cultural demographic. It was not done lightly.
Do you think that moving forward, we have seen some big steps and changes that have been sustained, or do you still think there's a lot of work to go?
I was at a round table discussion only a few weeks ago where the same thing was being talked about, Rachel, how to engage women of minority backgrounds into a certain sector. And on the one hand, I wanted to be the accidental activist. But on the other hand, I felt almost as though the landscape is constantly changing. With every generation, there are new barriers to access, whether it is to do with colour, whether it is to do with gender, and how this next generation identifies in terms of gender. Mm. So that is another form of representation. So the landscape is evolving and changing very, very quickly all the time. I feel as though it's one of those very political things, and without getting on my soapbox, because I could be here for a very long time, talking about how I feel as though it can sometimes be one step forward and a few steps backwards. A very high profile person came out recently as well and said something, and because they're in the public eye, it was dismantled, it was distorted, and it was fed back to the public through a tabloid, actually, that then had huge repercussions on that high profile person, to the point where there's a cancel culture.
Yes.
You have to choose your words very, very carefully. I am a woman of colour. I am from a South Asian background. Even I have to think about how I put my words out there so that there is no repercussions, negative repercussions on me. So the landscape, I can't give you a straight answer on that, I'm afraid, Rachel, because it is something that is constantly moving and being appropriated at every stage of human evolution, I guess.
Yeah, which I think there is that frustration actually with the cancel culture, because how can we move forward and have really open and honest conversations and allow space for people to get things wrong so that we can learn from one another without it being cancelled? It is quite it's a balancing act, isn't it?
I really feel for people of my generation, because there was no such thing. Political correctness was not even on the vocabulary. Mm. As you'll have read in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
Political correctness, positive action. These words were alien. Yeah. They only came about in the late 80s, 90s. So there are lots of people in my generation making these faux pas unintentionally, inadvertently, and within a blink of an eye, they will be cancelled for saying the wrong thing. So my heart goes out to several people I know who have innocently said things unknowingly because they haven't been equipped often with the vocabulary that is, you know, our current way of woke culture of making sure that I's are dotted, T's are crossed. And it's quite a challenge, Rachel. I'm sure you see it.
Yeah, no, I do. Yeah, I do. It's that fear of wanting to get things wrong, but also wanting to learn and have these conversations.
Absolutely. So I think we're often on interesting ground. And I have very young children, 13 and 8. So they keep me on my toes, which is an advantage.
Yes.
I think it's good to know, you know, what the word on the street is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because otherwise I'll be very cringy if I'm not already to my 13-year-old.
Well, that's your role.
I think so. It's our job to embarrass them.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I know another subject that you and I are really passionate about is the menopause and making sure that women have the right information out there. And I'm talking from a privileged background of being able to get that information very easily. And it's not the same for all women across the country. And I know that's something that you're really passionate about, aren't you? Trying to get that message out there to those underrepresented communities that don't have the resources, the same access, for whatever reason. What's your experience been in this area?
Again, I feel as though, like yourself, I'm in a very privileged position, Rachel. I fought hard for this position. It didn't come overnight. And a lot of it is educating yourself. There isn't a huge toolkit of information for all women out there, let alone marginalised women. And we are talking about barriers, cultural, but also language barriers. We're talking about economic barriers. So it pertains to all women. But having listened to the voices, particularly of ethnic minority communities, there isn't a definitive word for menopause. And if there is, it's quite a derogatory term that I suppose it is in the English language as well. Everything stops, menopause.
Yes. Yeah.
Everything's on hold, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like we've done our job. And I suppose 200 years ago, that would have been the case.
Yes, yeah.
You know, we wouldn't. Women didn't live as long.
No.
By age 50, it was coming to the end of your life, thankfully, with medical science. we have much longer lifespan, so we're living into our 80s and 90s and 100s. So if menopause hits you in your 40s or 50s, you've got another half of your life to navigate without your estrogen.
Yes.
Everybody has a choice. I'm not here to bang the drum and tell women what they should be doing. I never have felt that that was my role to judge or to tell people what they should be doing. But create awareness is where I feel my job is, to make sure women understand that when they hit perimenopause and menopause, that their estrogen is gone. And the estrogen, as we know, is the building block from a scientific, let's talk science, from a scientific point of view, estrogen is the building blocks of basically every bodily function we have, from joint to brain health to cognitive and everything else we need in our day-to-day life. And having very young children, I need my cognitive
wheel
turning and writing a book.
Yes.
My 50s.
Yeah.
You need all your faculties very much present to do that. And in order to do that, you have to explore what options are available. And, you know, there are people who say, you know, they want to go through it naturally, which I will celebrate as much as people, as women who say that, you know, they want to take something for it. So I'm not here to judge, but I'm here to educate, especially when there are groups of women who don't even know they are going through it. And in this day and age, you'd think that somebody must be hiding under a rock.
Yes.
Sadly, that exists. I'm not saying they're hiding under a rock, but the information and the reach and the outreach to those communities needs an awful lot of work. And if I'm in a position where I am able to facilitate that through my networks, which I am, I'll happily give that to those women and make sure that they understand that they are going through various changes. I've heard some very sad stories, which I don't need to talk about, which I'm sure you have as well, where women feel almost so disempowered to the point that they feel they have no worth. That for me is the saddest part, when a woman feels that she is neither valued, respected, given the esteem to run a small community. And in many communities, not just the Asian community, but a woman really is in charge of a family, and a family is a small community. And whatever knowledge you give to the woman is going to be cascaded to her daughters and to the next generation. Yeah. So I feel it's a very strong responsibility I have.
And how do we make those changes? How do we kind of create those outreach projects to try and build these links between the resources and these smaller communities that need the help and the resources and access to them?
A lot of it is to do with having... And it may sound very corny, but having role models and having somebody that women can look to, relate to by virtue of ethnic background. And even if that is relevant or not, I talk to women of all cultural backgrounds, Rachel. I don't see my job specifically as talking to, you know, people of cultural relevance, even though that does resonate more with me. But I think it's good to know that there are people out there that can be approached. I'm on several social network platforms. My voice is quite loud, and I feel a responsibility through my engagement, through my social media platforms, through my columns, through my book. I see myself as somebody who is accessible, and I do have a very full box of direct messages where women do approach me, and I'm glad I have that ability to be accessible and amenable to lots of women. So making sure those networks are there. And I'm not a clinician, so I cannot diagnose and advise, but I certainly can direct people to the right person who can. But if I'm able to open a door for them, I feel that that helps. And if there are more, and there are more people like me, there are some amazing clinicians, of ethnic background doing amazing work, so I'm not on my own, and that's very reassuring to know.
You're not, but I do find that they don't get the same platform amount of time on certain platforms. You don't hear them about them as much.
Yeah.
And I think that that really does need to change. Because I don't think they're given the same opportunities to share what the work they're doing as perhaps some of the other women out there.
I agree. I usually find them.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm quite analytical. I'll go and find the person that needs to be found. And I found probably the most senior person in the menopause world and brought them out and made sure that they were aware. And I actually got a platform on their podcast as well. So that was brilliant because this podcast is global.
Yeah.
And it has reached many ears. So I made sure I found the person I needed to find to get that message out.
I love your determination. I love it. It's brilliant and we need more of it. But you know, you were talking about, it's almost like creating a ripple effect, isn't it? Because it's not just for our generation. It's for the girls coming up below us. It's the women, the younger women in their 20s and 30s that need to know this information before they get there. How was your experience of going into the perimenopause?
From a generational point of view, I am the youngest of four girls. So I was lucky in the sense that there was some shady information, but not enough.
Yeah.
I had to go and do my own research. I knew by my mid-40s, I had my daughter in my 40s, so hormonal fluctuations were awry.
Yeah.
In my early 40s. So I put down a lot of my own. Whilst I didn't get the classic menopause symptoms, hot flushes or anything like that, I feel as though I was quite lucky to avoid all of that. My symptoms were more mood related. So I knew there were days that I wasn't feeling myself. For somebody like me who is, I consider myself a very upbeat, positive person who grabs life. And when that started to falter a little bit, I knew there was something that was out of kilter. Thankfully, at the time that I was feeling a little bit out of kilter with my own moods, and I had an instinct that I was going towards a perimenopause in my late 40s. Louise Newson came on the scene. She is the loudest voice,
yes, she is,
in the menopause world. I love Louise's determination, activism, breaking glass ceilings daily. And she was very much at the forefront of everything to do with female hormonal health, not just menopause and perimenopause, but hormonal health in its entirety. I had access to that, and I remember listening to her on her platforms on TV and knowing that those symptoms that I was experiencing were very much in that bracket of perimenopause. I started to do my own research, and as most women on the same journey as myself, knocked on the door of the GP. It took three knocks, Rachel. It took three attempts to get through to the GP that I was perimenopausal. And rightly so, I'm sure clinicians do get slightly aggrieved when people self-diagnose. But this is something that is so personal to a woman that there is no choice but to self-diagnose, to write those notes, to monitor how you're feeling.
Yeah.
It's not depression. It can go into depression left untreated, but when you get those fluctuations in moods and certain symptoms as well, if you do experience, you know, a certain achy joint, you know that you are heading towards midlife. Old age doesn't cut it anymore.
Do you remember?
Because to me, old age is 90s.
Yes, it is.
And hundreds.
Yeah.
But right now, I feel as though, you know, I have a lot to give. So I knocked on the door of the GP three times, and I actually, again, went straight to the source. I approached Dr. Louise Newson and said, I'm getting a bit frustrated here. The door seems to be slamming in my face. Let's just say the nice guidance were opened and shown.
Yeah.
And I got a call from my GP to say, your medication is waiting for you. I did decide to go down the route of HRT because I know for a fact that once the estrogen has gone for me, I wanted to replace it, replenish it. I have a young family. I want to look after them to the best of my ability. I want to be the best of my ability. So for me, that works. And with all the research, with all the research that dismantled a lot of the flawed research. Mm. So I looked into that. I don't take anything lightly. And that includes medication as well. Yes. And that proverbial, I don't even take a headache tablet.
Yeah.
Cliche. I don't even take a headache tablet, really. You know, I like to kind of see it through. But when it came to my hormonal health, I did the research. I saw that all the scaremongering and the flawed research was based on research that was done in the 70s and 80s. So realized the new bioidentical hormone is the way to go. Yeah. For me, it works. That was my journey. It took a long time to get the actual medication I needed. And now I feel as though every woman is much more equipped. Even in 2 years, the landscape has shifted so much.
Yeah.
Every woman I know in my age bracket knows her choices. Whether they take hormones or not, that's up to them. But at least they know that the options are there. So, you know, the women who are like I said, of my generation, your generation, our cultural background, it's available and it's accessible, thankfully.
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I went on it in 2018 and for me, it works and I'm so glad that I'm on it and completely the same as you. If somebody decides not to go on it and they decide to go different routes, then I'm all for that. It's just about getting the information out there so that you can make informed choices.
Absolutely.
And I know that you are all about healthy lifestyle, really looking after yourself, longevity, which comes through in your passion for food and cooking from scratch, which is something that you do on your Instagram every day. Every time I see it, Frieda's post, it's like, oh, that looks so nice. So yeah, where's the passion for food come from in all this?
Food is definitely akin to art for me. So my background as a fine artist is the route I chose to go down. I was passionate about creating, making, and art in its broadest sense. We live and breathe art. I think we all have that ability to be an artist, but I chose to go down professional route and study it. And food was almost at the same kind of level for me, and exploring making a dish is the same as, you know, creating something from scratch. It's creation.
Yes.
My art is very different. It's conceptual and it's based on space, time and light. So I am an installation artist. I feel food is also resonates with people. For example, I'm invited to do guest chef dinners. So I'll look at the demographic of those venues, look at the people that would normally frequent those and cater an 8-course meal specifically to that demographic, but at the same time open the doors for new people to walk through those venues. So creation in its broadest sense stretches from making something that people look at in an art gallery, but at the same time on a plate as well. You eat with your eyes, so whatever you look at, obviously you savour it first and foremost with your eyes. There was an experiment conducted where people were given a blindfold and tasted something that they couldn't quite recognise. You know, the texture was akin to a banana, but it could have been anything because, you know, half of the enjoyment of food is actually visually how it stimulates your sensory experiences before you tuck in, as we say in Yorkshire.
Yeah. There is a restaurant in London, isn't there, that does that. You go in and you're blindfolded, so and you're actually, it's pitch black.
Oh.
So you don't see any of the food that you're eating. And I wouldn't get my head around that. That would be really interesting.
That would be an interesting sensory. Yeah. That is art to me.
Yes.
You know, textures obviously resonate on your tongue, but smells as well. You've got 5 senses, smell and texture, but sight is the biggest one for me. So when things look beautiful on a plate, I can't help myself. Even when I'm serving food for the children, you know, they'll be waiting for me. Oh, Mum, it doesn't always have to look Instagrammable.
You know? It does. It does,
though. For me, you know.
Beautiful.
But, you know, as I said, and hopefully that will translate to how they savour and know how to make food. My 8-year-old daughter, she knows how to create so many dishes from scratch, which I did at her age. I was quite adept at making a good base for most curries by 8-9 years old. And it stands them in good stead for the future, because they'll go off to college and university, and I want them to be able to fend for themselves. And a huge part of survival is making sure you're getting the right nutrition so they know the basics.
Yeah.
For me, going back to your original question, food is elementary. It's not just about styling. It's about making sure that you're getting the right nutrition as well. Whilst I might appear to be this holy grail and mantra of all things healthy, I do like sugar, Rachel. That's my weak point, I have to say. And I've looked at different forms of sugar. You know, there are coconut sugars, there are stevias, there are fruit sugars, but it's nice to face plant the odd pastry and trifle. And chocolate isn't my biggest thing, but yes, I do like, I have a sweet tooth. So I don't say no to anything, actually, unless it's going to be very detrimental on your health.
Mm.
And that's kind of a no-brainer now. I'm not on my own in advocating healthy food. There's millions of us out there on various platforms, and
yes,
I'm often in admiration and in awe of some of the amazing food bloggers out there. So I'm still learning, Rachel.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of our age, isn't it? That we've got this freedom to be evolving still, and to be learning, and
exactly,
to be curious, and to go with the flow and see what direction it takes us. And that's what I love about you, is that you've had lots of different strings to your bow along the way, and you've tried lots of different things, but it's all around the same core values of all the work that you're doing. But what's next? So you've got the book out, and I can see how that could really translate to a screenplay. So I know that might be something that will come up next. But what is next on the cards for you?
I have a responsibility to write a sequel, because anybody who's read the book,
yeah,
we'll know that there is a cliffhanger at the end, which leads us nicely onto the sequel. So I've already started incubating that in my head and turning that around, and know that that's on the cards. I have a few amazing opportunities ahead, and I don't want to jinx them.
Hello.
But funnily enough, a screenplay was actually on the cards before the book. The book,
right,
came after. So how that pans out, let's just, you know, watch this space on that one, because I think it's an interesting one. Stories aren't often told through the eyes of women.
Mm.
And I feel as though in my 50s, I'm embracing being a feminist, actually, and I don't say that lightly. I feel that it is a responsibility that I have to bang the drum for the next generation. I have a daughter. You have daughters, Rachel.
Yeah.
You'll know this. It's a responsibility that we have collectively as women of wisdom who have travelled the road, the rocky road.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And we've got so much to offer, and they don't get written off.
And on that note, I think there is a trajectory there, which I feel as though I'm on to, again, I don't use this word patronisingly or lightly, educate, inform the next generation, boys, men, girls, women, to be aware of language, terminology, etymology of language, and how that's often been used to elicit emotions,
yeah,
that create perceptions. I told you I was analytical, didn't I?
Yes, yeah.
So get to the root of why we think a certain way, and it's often the language we use. Very careful about the language I use around young people, around people of my generation and older, because I feel, again, it's a responsibility we have as human beings to plant seeds, watch them germinate, and create thoughts. So I think there are so many different ways I can express my own trajectory without sounding it's all about me.
This is your moment. This is what I try and encourage women to do, to talk about how all the good stuff that's happening with you, because you've earned that and it's well deserved. And as women, we're often kind of, we were told from a young age not to bang our drum about how great we are and the things we're doing. So now is your time to do it, definitely.
Okay, then I'll indulge myself.
Yeah,
and you
won't go for it.
But I feel as though it is a responsibility that we have, and I call it bragging rights.
Absolutely.
Feel as though we've traversed some very rocky terrain, one being a woman, two being a woman of ethnic background, three growing up in 70s Yorkshire, which was no walk in the park. But all these opportunities, they were not barriers, depending on how you looked at them, with curiosity, I guess, which is how I looked at them. And I saw them as a way to... They certainly shaped my character. And moving forward, I see different kinds of glass ceilings for women younger and of my generation. I have the bragging rights to say, I've been there, I've done that, I've worn the T-shirt, and this is how I navigated that. If that helps you, brilliant. But your journey might be different, and that's great too. But I feel as though I'm privileged and proud. I stand proud, Rachel, of everything I've achieved, and the voices in my head that do often feel the imposter in me, again, to use an overused word right now, the imposter exists in everybody.
Yeah.
There are real imposters, and there are imposters in your head. And then there are sadly people who want to stop you on your journey. To me, they are the quiet voices. The loudest voice in my head is now my own.
Love that. Brilliant. And that's perfect to my kind of last question that I always ask all my guests is, if you were to pay yourself a compliment, what would it be?
That's a difficult one, actually.
It has brought out lots of different reactions from women. I have had some women in tears because they found it really hard to compliment themselves.
I am a polymath. I am adept and skilled in so many areas which I have worked at, I have studied. I understand philosophy, I understand science, I understand the arts, I understand different languages, I understand how to communicate. I am a polymath.
I love that, and I love that you're owning it. It feels like you're still on this big trajectory, and there's going to be lots more exciting things to come. So thank you so much for sharing it with me. How can people find you?
The most obvious way is to find me through social media. I'm Googleable. Sounds corny. But I think the first hit is my social media platforms. My biggest one is Instagram, where I share my recipes daily. I have columns as well, but just find me on Instagram.
And what's your Instagram handle?
It's Frida Shaffy, Spice It Up.
Perfect. And my last question that I ask all my guests, what does liberty free to be mean to you?
Hopefully everything I have encapsulated right just now in this podcast is there are no boundaries. There are only boundaries that we perceive, and we should be challenging those boundaries if they are there to limit us. And be aware of yourself, embrace yourself, be free. Liberty is all about freedom. So be free to own your thoughts, be justified in your thoughts, stand true to your values.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful way to end. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. So thank you so much for your time, Frida.
Thanks, Rachel. This has been an absolute pleasure for me too.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And I will be back in a fortnight. But in the meantime, keep being fabulous.
Thank you for listening to the Liberty Free to Be podcast. I hope it's left you feeling inspired. If it has, why not join the free Liberty Lifestyle Hub over on Facebook? With over 300 women all at different stages of midlife, making new connections and supporting one another. Don't forget to come and say hello at Liberty Free to Be on Instagram. I'd love to know what free to be means to you. If you're loving the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Your support is much appreciated. I'll be back in a fortnight, but in the meantime, keep being fabulous.